Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm back in my lunar podule this week. No, my comma's in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Even the grammar it stops in.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
Hello, and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, we discuss moon landing masterpiece Apollo 11, plus some crate digging has found us some forgotten Beatles with Yesterday, the new film from Richard Curtis, who is this week's guest. I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm back in my lunar podule. This week, two cinematic explorers who, between these two films, have made quite the journey across the universe. Welcome to Caitlin Quinlan and Sam Howlett.
Hiya.
Before we talk to Himesh Patel, here comes the moon. Let's start with Apollo 11. On the 16th of July 1969, the United States entered the race to the moon by launching a three-man spacecraft, drawing from over 11,000 hours of recordings and 18,000 hours of audio. Apollo 11 is the spine-tingling story of their mission. It's got never-before-seen footage from kind of 70mm IMAX mega footage to 60mm, 8mm personal stock from NASA. Unheard audio. It's directed by a guy called Todd Douglas Miller, who made a film called Dinosaur 13 a few years ago. And it's made up of these first-hand recordings that have been synchronized for the first time. And for me, this is probably one of the best films to come out this year. Guys, do you think it's...
It is great. Yeah. It's just a great...
It's just great that it's brilliant,
it's
isn't it?
It's just so good. It's just the best.
It's good when things are good, isn't it?
Oh, man. I was
just
so excited.
I love it when things are good.
Yeah. This played at Sundance earlier in the year, and it was like... This is a film of never-before-seen NASA footage in IMAX.
Nerds out in film.
Oh, please. God. Yeah, so the audio comes from Mission Control, which is that bit that we all know from the films with the big screen and the guys on the computer. And then you've got the footage from inside the capsule of the moon or of all the astronauts. And none of it had been synced up before. And so there was just this idea, there was all this audio and all of this video, but never had been put together
in such a way.
It's like
this complete feat of filmmaking that's, you know, I mean, obviously the moon landing was very impressive, but this is very impressive.
You're saying this is more impressive.
this is the major event.
Not more impressive than the actual moon landing, but as a piece of work and a feat of filmmaking, it is quite remarkable, I think.
Yeah, I think it is incredibly impressive work. And it's just incredibly overpowering from the start of it because we feel like we know these events. This is one of the most publicized events in human history. Like 600 million people sat down and watched this. It is one of the most watched things ever. And yet we watch this film and it feels completely new and it feels like we're watching it for the first time. And I think that in a way that shows how important sound is to a film. Like so often we hear directors say that your sound is 50% of the work. And it may well be that although these images are familiar, it's the fact that we're getting that sound along with it that makes it feel so fresh.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think it's funny that we're talking about this so close to Maradona, which is similarly a film that is entirely made up of archive footage where nothing new is created as such. It's all done with things that exist before. It's a real like mosaic in that sense. And it's a way, and this film doesn't even have any kind of narration or any voiceover or like talking heads, anything like that at all. It's all just so like observational, stripped back, like this is what happened. We're going to put some music over it and that's it.
Yeah, yeah, it feels totally observational. It's weird because you know it, because it's archive and because it's, we know how much footage has gone into it. And the fact that the film is 90 minutes long, like obviously this has totally been manipulated. This is pure editing. This, but it's also completely observational at the same time. I mean, it feels like a genre film at times as well.
Yeah, 100%. Everything about it is so... A ticking clock essentially goes through the whole film. A ticking clock is there before the blast off. A ticking clock is there before they do the orbit of the Earth to go straight to the moon. And then there's another countdown when they land, and then a countdown when they lift back off. The film is made up of loads of different countdowns, which just ramps up the tension, even if it's not a tense moment. Because, as you say, this shouldn't be a tense film. We know what happens.
Yeah, this is the crazy thing. Everyone in the world knows that this went fine. Like,
I know, but the thing is, it's like, you know, at the time, I think that's what it does so well, is it immerses you kind of back in that time. And obviously, you know, if we were watching back then, we would have had no idea what was going to happen. There was so much at stake, so much, you know, risk involved in this mission. And I think it does such a good job of planting you right back in that moment where you are kind of questioning. I mean, you know, I know they landed on the moon. I know it's fine, but you do really feel like you're just back in that time, and you're experiencing the emotions and the turmoil of everyone involved in this mission.
Yeah, and it does a great job. Some of us may not be familiar with the workings of a rocket or the physics of the solar system, and it does a great job explaining to us just the tiniest bits of information that we need to know what they're up to, what this bit of footage attests to. Like, is this going around the Earth? Is this going around the moon? And they've got these great little animations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think those are one of my favourite parts of the film, actually, is these kinds of graphics that appear at sort of pivotal moments that explain exactly what the rocket's doing and how it's going to manoeuvre itself in space and how parts are going to detach. And it's so simple. Like, the drawings are very, very simple, but they're so informative. Like, you know, they're so, it makes this concept very graspable, I think. And there's something really nice about that it doesn't assume you know everything, but it also doesn't kind of... It doesn't necessarily dumb it down. It's just a very kind of coherent and easy to understand sort of explanation of what actually happens when a rocket tries to land on the moon.
Yeah, and it's the only time that we feel the modern touch of the filmmaker in the film, I think, anyway, because obviously those animations weren't there on screen. They had to be put in there by someone. They don't feel like the footage is being manipulated to bend to the will of the filmmaker. It's the fact that the style of those animations, those lines, that they... Their genesis is within the textbooks of NASA, that they are stylized to match.
You can almost imagine them being drawn on whiteboards and chalkboards or whatever to, you know, to explain to, you know, whoever in the room.
The mathematicians gave it to the engineers, who gave it to the astronauts, all these textbooks of how everything's worked, which included these drawings, and those drawings would inspire these animations.
That's amazing.
Also, NASA, 1969. If you buy 5 coffees, each one is 5 cents, you get the 6th one free.
Really?
There was a sign in the film.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Forget the space.
Good
stuff.
Observation.
Like, wow. Yeah. Look at the look at those coffee prices. That deal.
And like, if now no one's doing free coffee at the 6th, they're doing free coffee at the 10th.
But this, again, you know, talking about how it immerses you back in the time, I think it's this great time capsule of America in that moment, especially, you know, America in that moment. And there's lots of footage of crowds and, you know, people at home watching and all the different kind of, you know, this was kind of a nationwide mission in a sense. You know, you've obviously the astronauts and the people working at NASA are, you know, far more crucial to it, and you do see them and you see how much of an effort it was and how many people were involved and the kind of, you know, the efforts taken. But you also have these wonderful shots of the crowds either standing like across the bay about to watch the launch, or you see people at home, and the footage is so vivid and rich and just just wonderful. I think, you know, even just looking at hairstyles and clothing and old cameras and cars, and I think, like, we were talking about the fonts used on storefronts and things like that. It's this really wonderful collection of images, I think, just to sort of sum up what America was like at that time.
Yeah. And those bits aren't just B-roll. They're a significant part of it. Because the bravest thing that the film does for me is that it doesn't give you a protagonist or an antagonist or a main character or anything like that. In this film, the easy option is to make Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins your main focus. But as much as the guys in the capsule are the focus, so are the people on the ground, so are the people in mission control, so are the friends and family. This feels so tense. And you're totally removing the idea of a main character to connect to as well. And you're just bringing that tension in from that collective consciousness, that collective nervousness about this mission.
And all from archive footage. It's, it's incredible.
You feel totally within that world, within that experience. It's the closest that we will come to ever watching that footage and being one of those 600 million, I think, anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
And if you can, please go and watch it in the cinema. I think if you've seen For All Mankind, the documentary from the late 80s, it's definitely one for you. But anyone who's got a passing interest in space or is a big fan of stuff like First Man, Apollo 13, Interstellar, these films that do root themselves within that reality of space travel a little bit anyway, it's definitely one to seek out for sure. All right. Sam, there is another film out this week that had a pretty long and winding road to getting into production. And you spoke to the man who helped get it there.
I did, Jake, I did. So this is Yesterday, which is the new film written by Richard Curtis and directed by Danny Boyle. So the film stars newcomer Himesh Patel, who audiences may know as Tamwar from EastEnders, as I did.
Did you?
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I never
watched it. I don't watch EastEnders.
He was in it for 10 years.
Wow.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I thought he was like a newcomer.
Yeah. We were like breakout star. Well, wow, no.
This is his first, major film.
His film role.
EastEnders, he plays Jack, whose career as a singer-songwriter is not going well. He has a best friend called Ellie, who's played by Lily James, who is his, not only his best friend, also his manager, who's also in love with him. After a mysterious blackout, it turns out he's the only one who can recall the Beatles' back catalogue. So with the iconic songs in his arsenal, he becomes the world's biggest singer-songwriter. But at what cost?
At what cost, indeed?
So I was lucky enough to sit down and speak to the great Richard Curtis.
Okay, Richard Curtis, welcome to the Curzon podcast.
I'm very excited to be here. I have so many happy memories of the Curzon. Many movies when I was young, not in the English language, but with any luck, still as perfect for being so. I think I saw The Phantom de la Liberté. I seem to remember seeing that movie once when I was young there, but anyway, it's great to be here.
So we're here to talk about Yesterday, of course. So this story came from, well, the concept came from Jack Barth.
That's right.
Talk about how you heard this concept for the first time, what kind of shape it was in, and then how you reshaped it.
I stopped the conversation quite quickly because my friend Nick Angel rang me, who was a producer of that film, and said, we've got this idea. And I can't remember if he was asking me to, you know, maybe even think about directing it or get involved. And I said, look, stop there, because if it's possible for me to write a film based on that sentence, I would absolutely love to. And so that's what we eventually worked out. So I would just had the simple idea, but, you know, the completely central and brilliant idea that Jack had had.
And it's interesting because from Love Actually onwards, it seemed like you were very much in this mode of like a writer-director until About Time.
And yes.
One would think you would have directed this. Have you stopped directing?
Have stopped directing. And what a lovely sort of proof of the pudding this one is, because Danny's made such a great job of it. I mean, I just felt as though I was a bit unhappy about sometimes the best scenes I would direct the worst, you know, because I thought the scene was strong and therefore I didn't know quite what to do extra.
Yeah.
And then I would watch those scenes and thought if I'd really got into it. I blame a guy called Drake Toramus, who made a movie called Like Crazy, and I so loved the texture of that movie and thought, oh, he's really doing something with people's feelings there that I can't do. On this one I decided not to do it, and then actually literally it happened by chance. Danny wrote to me and said, have you got anything you know, on your books at the moment. And I just finished the movie, you know, that day. So I sent it to him, and the rest is yesterday.
Yeah. And how easy was it then to kind of part this off to Danny to, you know, shape in whatever way he wanted? Or were
that isn't how I've ever right. worked. And Danny, you know, was really happy with that. So he told me, you know, how he'd like the script changed, and sort of that was a bit conditional on him doing it, because Danny doesn't want to do anything he doesn't want to do. And I was happy with that. He'd spotted some flaws, but more, he found things that we could sort of expand and make more fab. Then, you know, we were very together on the casting. I was there all the time the movie was shot, but mainly to eat the bacon sandwiches, because I obviously couldn't really advise Danny on how to direct. And then, you know, we kept on discussing the edit right through to the very end. So it is a partnership, sure, but with, you know, him very much the senior partner as far as the directing, and him being very respectful, delightfully respectful of the script, which, because he likes to really lock the scripts. So he knows what he's, if he knows what he's shooting on a day, he can then shoot it marvelously rather than having to worry about the script and the content.
Okay. So getting Beatles tracks into a film then, I'd imagine that's not the easiest thing to do in the world. How did that come about? What was the sort of mission to get that done?
It was, I've kind of forgotten the sequence of events, but basically at some point quite early, we must have been quite confident we'd get a deal.
Yeah.
I think that it's, you know, I think it's Sony Publishing, and they were all covers. So it wasn't that we had to sort of watch very carefully the original Beatles songs being juxtaposed with, as it were, like videos, they wouldn't want. I also think, you know, it helped that it was a sort of love story and about music and by me and Danny, whereas if it had been, you know, Ted Bundy, the serial killer's enthusiasm for Beatles songs, they might have said no. So eventually we were in the blissful situation of being able to choose which songs, and, you know, as long as we didn't do more than 15, I think it was.
And how did you choose which? Because obviously the whole Beatles library, there's so many you could pick. How did you pick which ones would go in the film? Was it very carefully selected?
Very carefully selected. Yeah. But I mean, what a luxury. There I am, I'm typing the film, and I've, as it were, got a filing cabinet of cards of Beatles songs. And I like, for instance, on the whole, we kept to the more famous ones, because that's sort of the joke of the movie. Sure. You know, if someone sits down in their living room and plays Let It Be, that's a crisper joke than if they play Rain, you know. So I think that I was sort of forced into the most famous bits of the catalogue, and then, you know, amazing lucky things. So I thought, oh, I'll use Help 2/3 of the way through, because that really is a cry for help, and that's when he's in trouble. Right. And there's Back in the USSR, so maybe that could be the first foreign audience that he plays to. And, you know, so eventually all the songs found their natural point.
So Himesh Patel, then, can you talk about his audition and what it was that made you feel like, yes, this is Jack, this is the guy?
Well, it's so scary when you set off to try and find a new leading man. Yeah. You know, I remember it was agony finding Hugh, and, you know, very complicated again finding Tom Sturridge and then Donald Gleeson. And so we were starting that same journey. But you discover about a particularly leading part, because you tend to have a rather, if with the smaller parts with sort of particular jokes attached, you're clearer.
Yeah.
But with a leading role, it could go so many ways, because in a way there's something more plastic about the leading character in the films I write. And a lot of the first people we saw, the music sounded a bit artificial, sounded like cover versions, sounded like karaoke, sounded like stage school. And suddenly Himesh came in with this modesty and wryness and mystery and slight melancholy. And then when he played the songs, they were him, but you could sort of see the original Beatles through them. It didn't feel like he was trying to grab them. It feels like he was just diving into them. So it was just, you know, casting someone to play a lead is a bit like falling in love. You have to, you kind of eventually decide who you want to go out with on 142 dates with every day for the next year. And it was definitely him.
Okay. And something that sort of surprised me about the film, and I think surprised a few people, is Ed Sheeran's role. Because from the trailers, I think people assume it's a cameo, but it's he's very much a full-on role. Was that there from day one?
Yeah, always, always. And I mean, I think I had confidence we'd be able to find someone famous who could deliver. And I mean, when Ed said, yes, I rewrote, you know, there were originally no jokes about tattoos and ginger hair, but now, and rapping, but now there are more.
Okay. And have you spoken to Paul or Ringo about the film?
I bumped into Paul at his concert, and he said, oh, I hear you're doing it. How's it going? I think he hasn't seen it. Ringo, I know, has seen it and wrote a lovely letter to Danny about it. So, I mean, I think the Beatles should always keep, they'd be well advised to keep at arm's length. They have created a perfect edifice. They don't need me or anyone to, you know, add to their legacy. But it's a great thrill to be able to, you know, use the songs.
Sure. So along with this and About Time, you seem to be experimenting with sort of ideas and genres. But then I think there's something that's in most of your films is this idea of falling in love. As you know, your career progresses, are you thinking of other ways to show falling in love in these weird different narrative structures?
Well, I mean, it's clearly my, you know, subject. And you do wonder why. But then I think when it comes to painters, why do all of Chagall's pictures look the same? Obviously, there's something in us which drives us to do the thing that we do. And I think that I'm interested, you know, I'm covering increasingly some things I'm very interested in. So in this one, it's in some ways also about work and home.
Yeah.
You know, he's got this massive work opportunity to be the only person in the world who remembers the Beatles. But really, Lily James is going to make him happier. So it's a little bit about that, which I struggle with every day. Should I do an extra hour at work or should I go home to the people I love? And in About Time was as much about sort of marriage and family, and Four Weddings was about friendship and love. So I hope I've covered, the love thing seems to be there. It seems to be my sort of soup can. I think that I'm trying to sort of get around the subjects that interest me.
Yeah. So it's quite a few years since Love Actually, and that's become this strange, almost cult film. How aware are you of kind of the way the audience perceives your films, and do you sort of keep track of how that changes over time?
Well, that's what an interesting question. I mean, I'm now happier about my work than I was like 15 years ago, because people seem to repeat watch. And one of the great things is, when you release a movie, there are always critics who don't like it. But very few people come up to me now and say, your films are shit. I mean, it would just be socially such a bizarre thing to do. You know, so you only really hear the good. I'm sure there are as many people who switch off Love Actually when it comes on the telly as stay watching. But I think we got particularly lucky with that one, just because of the Christmas thing that it seems to become.
Every year it gets
renewed. Yeah, it seems to become a habit,
Okay, and can you talk about your writing process then, and kind of leading on from that, do you have stuff in your head that you want to do next after this?
Well, the writing is, I can't remember. That's the weird thing, you know. I think I know, I mean, there are some things I know I always do, which is that when I'm writing, I'm aware of, unlike a novelist who sits down and has to, I imagine, make every page perfect as they go along.
Yeah.
I'm aware that sometimes I'm writing plot, sometimes I'm writing scenes, sometimes I'm writing characters, sometimes I'm writing jokes, and I tend to, you know, slowly add to the plot and the story and then go back and say, well, how would these two people talk to each other? And then I write 10 pages and then I take out the best bits. As far as what I'm going to do next, I actually don't know at the moment, because I'm going into a year of campaigning about the global goals for the UN. So let's see what happens.
Okay. And finally, I just want to ask you, if you ever rewatch your own films and revisit them, and when you do you kind of think, oh, God, did I write this? And things like that.
Well, it is funny how how they seem to me to have been slightly made by a different person. Yeah. The person who wrote Love Actually seems pretty perky now to me, you know, and Blackadder's a mystery to me. But I think the funny thing about writing movies is the moment they're locked, they become a very expensive diary. So when I'm watching a film, I think, oh, she wasn't in a good mood that day. Oh, God, the prop's not right. I remember the light being difficult. You know, it's quite difficult for me to actually say that is Bridget Jones. I mean, it's sort of, it's Renee, and there's Hugh, and there's Colin. But one of the great things about before you lock a movie is you have to have this thing where you sort of vacuum your mind and say, oh, I wonder what's going to happen to that guy. I don't know. And I think that's one of the great self-disciplines that you have to do is when you make a movie.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Movie is to have that permanent ability to sort of be innocent about the story as you're working on it.
Great. Richard Curtis, thank you very much for your time.
It's a great honour.
This story that we've got, this one guy is the only guy in the world to remember the Beatles. It's such an odd one. And it initially came from Jack Barth and Mackenzie Crook, as writer Mackenzie Crook of The Office and Detectorists. And on this version that we see in the film, I think Jack Barth retains a story by credit. Mackenzie Crook is thanked at the end. And this is because it came into Curtis's hands, or the idea did.
That's right.
But he didn't want to know what the whole script was.
No, I think he was sort of pitched, or like someone said to him from working title, oh, there's a really great idea floating around. It's what if one guy was the only person in the world to remember the Beatles? And then he goes, okay, stop. That's all I need to hear. I'll go off and do what I want with that idea.
Yeah. And I have to say, once I saw the trailer come out,
yeah,
I thought, this is so mad that I have to see this film, because it just seems utterly ludicrous. And I don't like this.
How wrong you were.
It's just really normal. It's a real normal film. It's not. It's very odd. And
it's very
in a
odd.
Way, like, I really admire it. Like, I, as I came out of it, I said, that is Richard Curtis's Welcome to Marwen. And I like Welcome to Marwen.
Right.
Because it is so odd. And it's clearly just someone's got their idea, they've got their vision, and they've put it on the table in front of us. And between Danny Boyle and Richard Curtis, I think they have made the film they wanted to make.
Good for them. I wonder how, I mean, hearing that one line of, imagine only one man remembered the Beatles. In a way, you can tell that that's all that he kind of went from. And I don't think that's necessarily the best way to approach a kind of story like that. Because this story feels very plot holey and quite it's absurd. But in a way, I think, if there was certain things ironed out, if there were explanations made for some other things, you could be kind of a bit more on board with it. But the script and the story, I think there's just something missing that doesn't quite put it all together in a way that makes much sense.
I think when you're going with something high concept like this, you need to figure out the rules of your universe.
About Time does really well. About Time has this idea where Donald Gleason discovers he can travel through time. He has to go to a dark corner or like a dark space, really think about it, and then he wakes up where he's planned to go back in time, and it affects the future when he changes time, and he changes things in his past, and it's so nicely dealt with in one scene with Bill Nye, his dad, who also has the same power. And that's it. And the film sticks to those rules that they talk about, and they have repercussions. And I know time travel is maybe easier to do because it's a common thing, but this...
Are you saying people forgetting the Beatles and only one guy remembering isn't a common thing?
I know, right? But with time travel, there's other things to grasp onto about the rules of time travel, whereas here it's a new thing, so the rules aren't quite as clear. But I don't think they've thought of the rules here.
Yeah, it's so interesting to watch, because so much of it is fascinating because of this idea and the repercussions that that could have. And so much of the fun that comes from the film comes from that. But then so much of the frustration of the film comes from that as well. Because you think, right, because you start doing the maths in your head, right? Yeah. If that didn't exist, then X didn't exist, then bloody, bloody,
and
blah.
This couldn't have happened and the whole story doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. But I think by the time you get to the end of the film itself kind of acknowledges that fact as well. And it's almost telling you to not care.
I think
and to just go into it as an opportunity to see this guy, to see these songs, to see a director really going for it as well. Everyone in the film is so going for it.
I think this film is a very roundabout way of kind of just saying how much they love the Beatles. Like, that's really what it is. It's fundamentally about how the Beatles bring everyone together and, you know, we need to remember, like, the joy of their songs and all this kind of stuff. But it's just a very strange way of saying that. And I feel like there could have been any, well, there are any other, you know, number of Beatles films. But this just doesn't, for me, it doesn't fit in that kind of, you know, there's too much going on. There's too many holes. But everyone does look like they're having fun, which is nice. Himesh Patel, the kind of the new star. I think he's great. He seems he's a great singer as well. Actually, I think good performer. That works really well in the film.
I think generally any time I was questioning the logic of it was any time that he wasn't in it.
Yeah.
As soon as he's on screen,
he's
it
really
lights
good.
Up. He's brilliant.
He's very funny as well. I think I think there are some jokes that fall a little bit flat, but the scenes with him, you know, it's a little hard not to kind of smile at what he's doing and his humour.
It's so exciting to see someone just appear on screen like that and just instantly be a star.
Yeah, it is exciting. And I think he is a star.
Yeah, and there's like a real mixed bag of supporting cast members as well.
Where do we start?
Yeah. So
this is like another, I think talking about sort of like directors fitting into boxes in a way, this film does have very many kind of box characters. I think some of them are quite absurd caricatures of like the, you know, the awful agent in America who's going to kind of lead him to fame and fortune, but really it's, you know, his downfall and, you know, those kinds of just, yeah. And then the kind of lovesick, you know, best friend from home played by Lily James.
That's just like Richard Curtis trying to flip his own trope.
Yeah.
And I think he's being self-referential here as well. There's a scene that 100% is a reference to Love Actually, which is, you know, maybe sweet, but a little kind of eye-rolling as well.
But I think putting the plot aside and any Ed Sheeran's aside.
Ed Sheeran's in this film so much.
Ed Sheeran is in this film too much.
I think he's like the third lead.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. but there is something to be said about just how unapologetic, how unironic it is. Like, it knows what it's about and it's sincerely going for that.
Yeah, it's completely unironic, completely sincere joy. And I think there's something to be said about that. That it's not too referential, it's not too winking at the camera. I think it is quite pure in a weird way. Like, it's just like, this is fun.
Yeah.
And that's all you need sometimes. So I think love is all you need.
Fun is all you need.
Fun is all you need.
And I mean, this is definitely one for Richard Curtis fans more so than Danny Boyle fans.
I don't think so.
Like, this is going to go down.
But what are Danny Boyle fans like apart from?
Yeah, exactly. Who knows what Danny Boyle?
Oh, I love the beach. Ah!
Yes. I think of all the Richard Curtis films, maybe if you like About Time a lot.
Yes, it's very About Time.
Sure. Yeah. And so that's Yesterday, along with Apollo 11, which are both out in cinemas this week. Sam, what's happening on demand?
On demand, you can watch the latest horror film from Peter Strickland in Fabric, and you can check out our podcast series Strickland on Strickland, in which we interview Peter on all of his films, and you can watch all of his films as well on Curzon Home Cinema. So that is Catalin Varga, Barbarian Sound Studio, and The Duke of Burgundy. Each of those have an introduction by the great man himself as well. So we've got a lot of Strickland going on.
Wonderful.
Delightful.
All right. If you've got any thoughts on Apollo 11 or Yesterday or in Fabric, let us know. You can tweet us at Curzon Cinemas. And if it's your first time listening to the show, just subscribe if you're there. Just click the button, you know. Leave us a review or a comment as well. That'd be wonderful. You can do that on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep up with all of us, you can do that on Twitter. Caitlin, you're over there at...
I am. I'm over there at CSA Quinlan.
Sam?
At Sam Howlett underscore one.
And I'm there at Jake H. Cunningham. Thank you so much for listening. Farewell.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.